Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and welcome back, Jared Johnson. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning indeed. Now, we've come together to talk about your 2009 film, Tony, after such a good chat about Muscle, your most recent film. It's one I've always wanted to talk to you about, myself personally, because having lived in London since 2000, and a lot of my time in London was spent around sort of Dalston and Shoreditch. I remember the first time I watched your film, it was a bit like a social documentary of parts of London that I hung around in. And I just couldn't believe that someone had made it into a horror film. And then looking at it with 2022 eyes, it is really like a social history document of a Dalston that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and even at that time, it had moved on so much to, you know, the late 90s or how I really remember it when it was like, you know, you had Brick Lane and you had just, there was the Clifton or a couple of Indian restaurants and that was it. You know what I mean? Mm. There was no, looking back to how it is now compared to then is amazing, you know, with the bendy buses and everything else, and everything's changed. And not only Dalston, Soho as well is unrecognisable.
Soho and King's Cross Station.
Yeah, King's Cross.
There's a few wide shots of King's Cross Station that's not it. Yeah. It doesn't look like anything like that anymore.
No. Massive change. Massive change in that period.
So that's exciting about the film anyway, because, like, you know, films shot in London tend to be about the iconic buildings of London, you know, and they're the buildings that don't really ever change, but you really get us down to street level with Tony. And I think even between the short that you made in 2005 called Tony, you know, the images of Old Street Roundabout, like, you've really got all the scaffolding up that's the tumultuous change that's about to happen in that area. You know, the bloody tech centre of London and all that kind of stuff hadn't happened in 2005.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I'm fascinated in is always location. Filming on location, you know, getting out on the streets.
Yeah.
It's like the stuff that I grew up loving was always, you know, stuff of New York in the 70s or you know, Paris, you know, just on the streets. So I think there was that fascination of not seeing it as much in a lot of London films. You know, there's examples, but I'm always fascinated, you know, by films that really capture that time, capture a certain period in time. And you can only really do it because obviously we look at period stuff now.
Yeah.
And, you know, CGI is coming into the fore for certain things. But still, when you look at period stuff, there's something slightly amiss when they try to recreate, because a lot of the time they overdo it, overcompensate.
Yeah.
You know, so all of the cars, like if they're setting a film in 1972, all of the cars will be from 1972.
Yeah.
There'll be no, like, 1950s cars still on the side. So trying to, and I think the thing with Tony, again, what was so, why it was so special was that I was obviously my first feature, and it was a short before, but with the feature, I had a certain set of, I won't say demands because that sounds too, but I had certain things that I just really wanted it to be, certain things I wanted to do, which one was shooting on film, two was shooting chronologically, three was like I was left alone with the writing of it. It was a very closed environment, where it was just me and the actors workshopping for a number of months. And no one was allowed to see the script. Not even the other actors could see the script outside of their character, you know. So
what was the importance of that to you in the process?
Just because so everyone was approaching Tony. I mean, obviously the importance of keeping it away from the financiers was important at that point, because obviously what we were doing was, and again, like going back to how we went from the short to the feature. So Paul Abbott, Paul Abbott had seen one of my short films. I'd invited him to see Tony when I made the short of Tony. And the next day he called me into the office, his office, and said, look, I think we could get the money to make this into a feature. And it was, he was going to put in 20K, and the film council, the idea was to go to the film council and say, can you match it? The film council, which is now the BFI. So again, it was a small amount of money, but obviously compared to what the money I was making my shorts for, it seemed like a huge amount.
Right. Okay.
You know, and we had like 11 days to shoot this film.
Blimey O'Reilly.
And on film as well. So that dictated, anyway, I use a long workshop process, but this was really long. This was really organic, you know, where I had a general idea of stuff with Tony, but it was very much driven by me and the actors in a workshop environment. And it was such a fun period, the development of that.
So when when you start the workshopping of it, I mean, you've made the short. Was the short made with workshopping in its development?
Yeah, I've always used that process. Yeah, but obviously for the film, it suddenly became. I mean, for the shorts, you know, it would have been around someone's front room, but for the film, it was suddenly like, okay, we've got an office for this. We've got a camera there. You know, everything's set up. We've got scripts printed out. You know, we could use all of Paul Abbott and Tightropes. You know, it felt like it was our own little production company in Soho. So
right.
that felt incredibly liberating and to actually be taken seriously. I think that was the point you get to where, you know, you make your shorts and you get into a few film festivals. But then, yeah, it became a huge step up. But what was good as well was that I had no real fear of that. And that, I keep saying, it was very liberating. And I mean, it would never, and I've said this to you before, it would never happen that way again.
Right.
You know, how we made that film, it would never happen again.
So in a way, it had its own energy, momentum that...
Yeah, and just the fact that, you know, I was left alone to create this world and, you know, to write a script. I say it's a script, but it was a document rather than a script. It was in a script format. Obviously, it was like final draft and everything else, but it was very... And I think a lot of that, it was half of the way I wanted to shoot, who I was inspired by, how I wanted to do it. But also there was insecurities there of you know, showing a script to people. You know, since, as I say, like since writing stuff like Hyena, which took like 3 years of research and you know, hundreds and hundreds of drafts, you realize, like when I look back at the Tony document, like it's such a sort of, it is a script, but it's not, if you know what I mean.
That's what
created such a unique, original little film, because there were no rules. There was no one saying, no, you need to have this happen at the third act. You need to do this. You need to do this. No one was telling me anything. So out of it came this great cult little film, you know, that's just a unique energy all of its own.
I guess at this point, we probably should say that for those, surprisingly, who might have come along for this ride who haven't seen it, Tony is a sort of almost like a biopic of a fictional serial killer, because it's his point of view. We're not trying to catch a killer. This isn't Silence of the Lambs or Zodiac. This is from the killer's point of view. But also, it's not a slasher film. It's not a sort of hunt and kill film either. It is the life and times of a man killing in East London, which makes it a really fascinating watch, because on the one hand, you do have that brutality, the ruthlessness, the cruelty, and the violence of a serial killer film. But also, you've given us a character who is compelling because it's him against the world in another sense. He's surviving in almost like he's almost been cut adrift from society, not just because he's a psychopath. Well, that's probably a great deal of it, but he's not inhuman in everything he does, and that's kind of what you dig into as much as, I mean, you know, it's not high on kills. This isn't, you know, the thrill kill watcher isn't going to watch this, but the sort of person looking for what a dark character is will find that, yeah, they have light moments.
Yeah, well, it was all about trying to show, have an understanding of why Tony is the way he is, you know, rather than it being too blatant. And I remember us talking about it before, and it was at one point I put some very subtle sound design in there of Tony's dad.
Yeah, yeah. I asked you about exposition. Yeah. Like, there isn't any. And you go, yeah, there is.
yeah. But it was so, and again, it was like, because it was my first feature, we were doing all sorts of stuff in the sound edit. But you know, there's that thing. I should have been more bold and maybe raised the levels somewhat. As well, it's like you're making it for like 5.1 cinema screen, and you know, once people are watching it on whatever they're watching it on, that sort of sound design that gets lost.
But when you're looking for it, Gerard, it's there. And then the big part of it is high in the mix, actually. But until you told me, because of what we're watching, you're watching a policeman stood at the door and your mind is elsewhere. But at that point, cut, the audio goes, don't you fucking speak to me like that or something. You know, it's like, so it's clearly another voice that's in Tony's head. But because of the narrative that's panning out, you're not really as concerned as what's going on. You're just wondering. I mean, this is the magic of the film. It's like, for some reason, and maybe I'm alone, but I don't think I am, you're worried about Tony getting caught, which is a ridiculous idea for watching a film about a killer.
Yeah, well, I think it gives you, at every point, you understand the reasons for what he's doing. You know, he's not just going out and willfully killing people or knocking people off. It's, you know, he invites people round. He wants to look after them. He wants to make them fish fingers and chicken nuggets and put on John Van Damme film.
Beans on toast, a bit of Paul Young.
And then someone will do something that slightly upsets him because they think that he's easily manipulated. And, you know, once he's pushed, it's the only way he can retaliate. You know, so I think everyone that comes into the flat, I mean, for instance, Dawn comes in and he loves Dawn. You know, he's not at all aggressive, but you know, the junkies were quite aggressive.
Well, the junkie put his foot on the coffee table, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's kind of like the first
one of them was not very nice, but the other one he let go, who was nicer to him.
Mm.
So there was always a reason. Obviously, the TV license guy. I remember at that time I was getting loads of letters from the TV licensing people.
Yeah. So you thought that was front and center of your mind when you're thinking who could knock on the door next.
Yeah. And I think I'd paid the license fee and they still were sending in saying, you know, this property has shown that there is no, that you're illegally watching. And it's like, yeah, I remember it being just an annoyance at the time. So I thought I'd put that in.
Well, I mean, you've sort of hinted at it in the way you describe how it's written, that it wasn't, you know, it couldn't be done like this way before because you weren't being told about Acts 1, 2, and 3 and somebody monitoring.
I mean, it's just not even being told, but just that the process that you have on every single other film or TV show where, you know, it goes through the notes process.
So in that sense, how did you then, with that workshop approach, what were the challenges for you without that notes interference then? What did you find was the most challenging aspect of developing it to be the film you shot that then, once it was edited, that's where you began to get your notes? But for you, what do you remember being the challenge in creating the Tony story, even without the influence of notes?
Well, no, it was always a case of wanting to do a slice of life, wanting to do like a Henry, but very much Henry was a certain, this was trying to tackle, make Tony a completely different character. So it became like, what if, you know, the social realism we're used to seeing with Ken Loach and Mike Lee and Alan Clark, what if it was from the perspective of the serial killer in that environment, you know, an environment of East London. So we're tackling those issues, but it's very much from a character's perspective we're not used to spending any time with. And hopefully understanding like I'm defending. But there was obviously a lot of abuse that went on with Tony, hence why he became so, slipped through the net and then became violent because of it.
Mm.
So trying to stick up for someone who's quite a nasty person, but trying to understand those situations. And then I think with a short film, it wasn't necessarily, the humour wasn't really coming out of it as much.
Mm.
And then once we did the film, it became very black. I think if you'd have gone one way of developing it, you could have made it quite serious and po-faced, but it felt so much stronger with a, you know, black streak of comedy going through.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Smudger and Mackie, I mean, you could do a spin-off film on them too, I think.
Yeah, there's them, and then there's, you know, the Ricky Grover characters.
Yeah,
I mean, Ricky's sort of playing against type, but then you've got like the dialogue, the sunbed scenes, and it's like that uncomfortable, you know, horrible humor, really.
I mean, I've seen it in. I mean, Julian Richards did a film called Last Horror Movie, which is a guy who basically tapes on the end of a hire. I mean, it doesn't work. It doesn't work as much now. But in the video age, he would follow someone home who's just hired a film, kill him, edit the kill onto the film, and then take the video back. And so the film would have this spliced cut into it of the last person who hired it, murdered it. But there's a scene around the table where you know he's the killer and he's with his sister, and you're laughing at him, goading his nephew, and she's telling him to behave himself and don't, you know, you're awful, you are. And it's like, and we the audience are going, you don't know how awful he is. You know, like the joke is, you don't know how awful he is. Like in the same way that, like, say, Neil Maskell's Job Centre character, he's almost got complete disdain. Well, he has got complete disdain for him. And when his phone on his text goes and he checks it and he laughs, and then he returns his attention back to him. And it's like, you're looking at a killer here, mate, and you don't know it. And that's the joke. That's the joke. The dark joke, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think, but going back to your point of like how do you, you know, what are you looking at to make this into a feature? It just became so easy to, I mean, there were scenarios that didn't make it into the film. There was characters that didn't make it, you know, but it was always about Tony around London existing in this world and, you know, meeting people. As you know, I was very influenced by the Dennis Nilsson story. That was something that stayed with me as a kid.
Mm.
And I was always fascinated with that story of the killing for company side, you know, because he didn't want people to leave. So he was obviously very influenced. His personality wasn't, but his look and his modus was very much based on Dennis Nilsson.
Because you go as far as the whiting up of the face and everything, the whole corpse.
Whiting up of the face. Actually, that is in the...
It's more exactly. It's more evident in the short, isn't it? Because in the short, you see...
Well, I did the masturbation scene, but we didn't want to do it in the feature. It felt too on the nose, really. I didn't want to do it again. So, but the white talc should sort of symbolize that's what he's been doing in the other room. And then obviously going to gay pubs and bars and picking guys up. So we were lucky enough to go in the joiners, use the joiners before it's gone now. But we went in there, like we started filming it there like 6-7 in the morning after a Saturday night.
Did you really?
It was, you know, again, like...
I bet the aroma was sweet at that time of the day.
It was indeed. There was lots of shenanigans going on. But it was, you know, on a budget like that, it's hard to get extras. It's hard to get all this stuff. So it's like, let's just go in. Let's just go in the joiners. And, you know, everyone will want to stay because it's kicking out time. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So it's like, you can go, or do you want to stay for another couple of hours and carry on drinking? And you can be in a film. So all of those characters in the background, they're all, or most of them, are joiners extras. Joiners regulars.
So was that literally a gamble you took on the day you turned up? You just said, look, we'll just see who wants to stay around?
Yeah, we had the permission of obviously the owners, and the owners were doing their bit to say, right, well, we'll stay open. And you know, it's that thing of having to improvise. If there was no one in there, obviously we'd have made it tighter shots. I mean, most of the activity is like in the toilet, and then he goes out to the bar, and it's mostly on him and Lorenzo. But yeah, we were. I mean, if you see those scenes, we were pretty. It was great because I recognised some of those characters in there. You know, they were always in there, in and around. So it's great to film in those, you know, it just blurs the line between, you know, what's real and what isn't. If you can get away with shooting in as many sort of real locations and
what's the challenge there with that kind of approach with shooting on film? Because obviously film isn't as readily easy to shoot with as digital is today.
We were in a good position actually. So David Higgs, who it was two DOPs on it. It's David Higgs and Dale McCready.
Right.
David Higgs had just come from doing the new Guy Ritchie. So it just wrapped on, I think it was Rock and Roller.
That's right. Yeah.
So he had a good relationship with Fuji at that time. He'd just come and, shot the new Guy Ritchie. Fuji were happy. So he's like, look, I want to do this tiny little thing. We're going to shoot it in 11 days. You know, can you do me a deal? And David had his own film camera. So we got an amazing deal on the Fuji stock, which was an amazing stock. And then I was talking about the workshop process. So we knew that script inside out, or those scenes around those scenes. It wasn't ever tied you know, there's always improvisation right up to on the day. There was always improvisation. And obviously, you know, if you're working with, you know, actors who are good at improv, then that's fine. But if you're working with people that are non-actors, then that's not so good. You know, sometimes, you know, you can get them to be spontaneous once, but they can't keep riffing on stuff. Whereas someone like Ricky Grover, also stand-up comic, is incredibly good at keep coming up with different stuff.
Oh, right. Okay. You
know? Yeah. Because he's used to being on stage and just thinking on his feet. And,
got you.
And just having you in fits of laughter. So we had a certain amount of film stock daily. But as we went along, we were being so good with it that that by you know, the fourth day or the fifth day, we started to get more. So we could then do longer takes and everything else. You know, you can do your long takes. It just depends on, you can't just, I mean, that's the luxury of shooting on digital, obviously. You can just let it run.
I'm guessing a big influence is the kind of Nouvelle Vague and cinema variety. You know, a lot of it feels like we're documenting, not filming, you know, in certain senses. It's almost like, you know, you give the film an energy, which is, even when you're in the confines of his flat, it still feels run and gun all the time. You know, you kind of there's a breathlessness to it that drama doesn't always have.
One of the big influences was Summer on the Estate. I don't know if you saw that documentary, Summer on the Estate, Kingsmead Estate in that area. It's all been knocked down now, but I think it's readily available on YouTube. But there was a certain atmosphere, and also it was very fly on the wall, and there was a lot of different, very fascinating, interesting characters in that documentary, and it became very influential for a lot of people of our age and around that area.
Got you.
It was one of those. I think it was first shown on ITV, like on a Sunday evening, and just everyone watched it, you know, and everyone used to sort of quote from it and stuff. So there was obviously a lot of documentary influences as well as film. And then stuff like Nighthawks, you know, the Ron Peck film, just capturing that atmosphere of, you know, Tony around those bars and streets and everything else. So
I've been listening to Jason Bailey's Fun City Cinema podcast, which is a podcast that accompanies his book, which is about the history of cinema in New York. And a lot of what they talk about the films is about how, certainly the 70s films in New York, is the city was a character. And I think that you've made Dalston and the bits of Soho that you go into an extension of Tony, haven't you? It's not just like, absolutely, Here's a scene and a location.
No. Funny enough, on Saturday, I walked past Tony's flat and it's being demolished.
Really?
The flats. Yeah, they've got all the police, you know, they've cordoned it all off. So it's going to be knocked down in the next month or so.
Blimey O'Reilly. What's the challenges there when you're with you and David sort of shooting like that, where it's the real environment? There's no help with it. It's just like the locations you've got are what you've got to deal with, haven't they?
Yeah, and also like having to get out of. I mean, we, the police were called a few times to various. You know, when we were in the phone boxes doing the phone box scene, the police turned up and said there were junkies, because obviously as well, I like a lot of long lens stuff and staying. You know, and where we were always behind Tony, there was a lot of people were reacting to Tony as if he was this guy. You know, in cafes, in bars, people giving abuse to him. Just by seeing this weirdo, because obviously he did look very strange with his little baggy
shot. You're talking your man and woman on the street are giving him abuse, not
yes.
just your, wow,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, yeah. And also that, I mean, it's a bit naughty really, but the scene where Davey's mum is looking for little Davey.
Yeah, yeah.
None of those, they all thought that he'd gone missing.
Right, okay.
I mean, obviously once we wrapped that little, section, we went up to tell people, look, we were filming this, but to sort of get the real reaction of people, she just went around and said, look, have you seen this little boy?
My word. Okay. That's a high gamble, isn't it?
Yeah, now I've got kids, I don't think I'd want to. I'd be wanting to frighten people like that. But there you go.
Yeah.
It was just. But it was again. It's just about shooting. We were so guerrilla. You know, as I say, we would turn up at places like, for instance, the charity shop, and just I would go, I love the look of this place. Let's get Tony buying a tire for his interview, you know, and he'd just walk in and we just walk in behind him, you know.
And that's what I noticed there with a lot of these scenes where you give yourself the flexibility to be fast and shoot where, because there's no dialogue, is there? So for a filmmaker listening in, is to see those scenes and how much they achieve with nothing being said.
Yeah. And they was, you know, I remember the final stuff, which was me, Dal and Peter in the West End.
Yeah.
You know, we shot all of that nighttime West End stuff. We were out there on a Friday night, walking around the West End. And apart from the occasional people that would shout something, most people just didn't take any notice of, because it was just three of us, you know? And obviously I wasn't near, Peter was ahead, Dal was there, I was a little bit to the left of him. So people are so busy looking at other stuff, you know, and getting on with their nights or going to the next bar. And yeah, so it's great. But the whole film was pretty much shot like that. I mean, obviously we had locations like the pub and the flat and everything else, but we were always ready 360, we were always ready to just, you know, make up something on the spot if we needed to.
What can you give an example of something that's in the film that is a made up on the spot moment that became?
Well, yeah, the as I said, the charity shop was totally, I just said, what a great charity shop, because we were filming in the sunbed shop next door.
Okay.
And then it's just about, right, okay, well, he does need to get smart for this sunbed shop. Maybe a nice little tie for his job, you know, when he's standing doing the sign, which don't really exist anymore, do they? The golf signs, golf sale.
Yeah. I used to work on Tottenham Court Road. They were a regular feature.
Yeah. So there was always those little... happy accidents, you know, where you could just say, okay, let's just film this.
Now, the elephant in the room talking about Tony is obviously the man that plays the titular character, Peter Ferdinando. Now he's in the short, so obviously he was always going to be Tony.
Yes,
and given that you use the workshop approach to developing it, what is it about Peter and what? And what was it that Peter brought to the character that you couldn't have imagined? You know, is there elements of choices he made where you were like, yeah, let's go with that?
Yeah, well, I think obviously we're cousins.
Okay,
Peter and I. So, and we're similar. We're sort of similar age. Mm-hmm. It's like a year between us. So we've grown up being sort of very close. And when I initially wanted to do my first short film, Peter was the only person that I felt confident enough to say, do you want to do this thing? I mean, Peter was acting from a young age,
right.
And a show, and then lots of sort of TV and film stuff, little bits, you know what I mean? You know, bits and pieces. But obviously from being a child actor, so then we did the short, and then Tony was something that we really felt like the short of Tony is okay. It was shot we did it on a bank holiday weekend, and it's not giving the opportunity. It's not that I ever had the idea. It was Paul Abbott really that gave me the idea of saying, how would you develop it? How would you like to develop this into a feature?
Mm-hmm.
I'd already been thinking about things like Hyena by that point. You know what I mean? I didn't particularly. I just saw it as a great little short idea. You know, of this guy on a council estate killing people. But so then it became a real journey of right. Let's do this properly. And Peter lost 2 stone because also I knew. the kind of actor he was, because we know each other really well. You know what I mean? So I knew that what he could do. So there was no real pressure on not having Peter play the full blown version.
It was just a
logical progression that we would do it. Now we could have the time and the money. And also everyone in that film was sort of most of the people there were ex-Anna. Do you know Anna Scher, the acting
school?
Yeah. Lots of actors from around North London, East London went through her school. But there was a lot of the actors were all part of the same kind of gang. You know, Neil Maskell, Lorenzo, Fran and George, Mark Mooney, Peter. They were all...
Got you.
Anna's. So it became like this little collective. And that was good for me as well, because I had this sort of ready-made little collective of actors. And also getting Vicky Murdoch, who was ex-Anna's as well, who was the lead in Christine, Alan Clark's film. So it was trying to get that continuing that connection to Alan Clark.
Okay.
Which was important to me, because obviously he's been a huge influence over the years. So yeah, we just went on the journey with it.
But in terms of well, especially then knowing how well you obviously know Peter going into making the film, what were some of the decisions that you know he's consciously made that you kind of go, yeah, that's taken Tony to...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he moved into the flat and lived there for the duration of the shoot. And, you know, everyone knew him as Tony in the local shops. I mean, he just immersed himself into... He freaked everyone out that worked on the film, the makeup people, the hair, the costume. They were all terrified of him. He was Tony for the duration.
Hmm.
He lived on that diet, stayed in that house, talked in that voice.
Really?
freaked everyone out. Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, he's Mark Mooney, who's in the film, who's an old friend of Peter's, didn't recognize him on the first day of shoot.
My word.
And has known him like for 20 years, you know, didn't recognize him. So we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun.
But there's some nice, like, wardrobe details even. Like, I noticed this watch through, obviously getting ready to talk to you. Like, he's wearing strap-over shoes, isn't he?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, that's such a...
Funny enough, he was having a clear out, and he found the old Tony shirt and all the costume last year. And he said, what do you think? Are we gonna revisit? I said, no, I don't think so. I don't think we are. Are we going to bring Tony back?
I mean, but like I said earlier, Doors, I mean, one of the things that I think is quite magical about it as a film is that clearly it makes no apology about it being about a man who's indiscriminately killing people. But because we're doing it from his point of view and because of how he is and the life he has, the film plays this horrible trick on us as an audience that we begin to empathise with him, whether we like it or not. There are obviously the jarring moments that stop us.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
But in this, I thought, you know, it's different tone, but in the same way that Man Bites Dog does it, where for a bit you're kind of laughing, you think it's funny. Mm. And then the film, in Man Bites Dog, the film asks you the question, what you're laughing at. Whereas I feel like you've managed to have your cake and eat it in some senses, that you get to Horrifiers and then you get to make, and you keep like a game of tennis, you bounce back and forth between the two, which I think is really a real testament to the film, I think.
Well, and also it's that, you know, we see what's wrong with how society is treating him, you know, from the job centre to the tan shop to everyone in society. You know, there's no way out for Tony, is there? He exists in that world. He's got his little pleasures of watching videos and eating his crappy diet. Mm. But there is no escape. And, you know, we're not saying, we don't know how intelligent he is, but we're saying that he's slipped through the net. He has no way of getting out of his situation anymore. Mm. There's no help for him in any way, shape or form. So I'm not saying that should make you into someone who is like Tony, but we can understand, especially with the what's happened in his past with his father and stuff, we can sort of understand how someone can get to where Tony is.
Mm, no, for sure.
And exist. And also is this idea of big cities and how we're never sure of who we're passing in the street. And we've all seen Tony's. The amount of times I still see Tony's and walking with a little bag, blue bags of shopping. Yeah. Hunched over, you know, and you wonder about their lives.
It's an absolute coder, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting that something as simple as almost like rounded shoulders and a blue clarity bag hanging by the hip is a sign of, you know, it does give.
Well, not necessarily, but just that those, you know, lost lives or lives that are sad lives, you know, people that have gone through stuff, not necessarily, you know, they're up to what Tony's up to, but just, you know, especially as I say, when you're living in a city full of millions of people, you're always drawn to those people that, oh, I wonder what's happened to them.
I mean, are you born and bred London?
Yes.
Yeah. You see, so I've only been in London 20 years, and I don't know how you see London from the inside looking out, but certainly from the outside coming in. It is one of the few places where you can vanish. If I go for a walk around Manchester, I never feel like I can vanish. Whereas, like I did it the other day, I came back from visiting friends in Marlow. I got off the train at Paddington, and then I walked from Paddington to Bond Street.
Yes,
and that's just, you know, just a, again, it's a pretty pleasant part of town. But you just I was invisible, you know, and you're passing people who are equally, you know, equally as inconsequential as I was. And that, because there's so many of you, and then you're surrounded by like built up, you know, you've got dense housing and you've got lots of cars, even, you know, even though we're at the tail end of a pandemic and it's not as busy as it was, it still is intense, London, and it's very easy to be invisible. And therefore, once you're invisible, it's very easy to be ignored.
Absolutely. And that's, the fascination with me with those, you know, invisible societies or invisible areas that we're not really privy to. And that's also what I carried on into Hyena, was all of those, you know, in West London, all of those secret little societies and areas, you know, the different makeup of criminal gangs, what areas they're from, how the code is different, just any.
I've never walked down the Edgware Road before, and the Edgware Road has got an identity.
Yes. Oh, it's I love it. In fact, I'm working on something at the moment, and me and the writer went and sat on the Edgware Road like 2 weeks ago, and just to soak in, you know, just to chat and stuff. But I love it. I love how, and I used to be a bike courier, or bike messenger, whatever you call it, years ago, and I just always what was good about it, I mean, it was horrendous. Job really, but what was good, I got to see so much of London. Like, even like I thought I knew London, but actually when you're a courier you get to see so much that you've never seen.
Mm.
And you realize, but also what's interesting is how your mood can change from one street to another. And I know that's like that with a lot of places, but it really is like the difference between, there would be no reason other than me just going, why do I feel like I'm, a bit depressed just at this point?
Yeah.
And then you would get to obviously areas, as I say, like you go to somewhere like Edgware Road and it's so sort of, it almost feels like you're abroad,
Yes.
You're somewhere yes. like it's so like, the smells are different. And I love that. I love the fact that you can just go to, you could go to somewhere like Vauxhall and just have Portuguese, or it's, there's so many different areas and there's so many different, cultures,
I think it definitely shows in both Tony and Hyena, that idea of wanting to use the built environment as part of your film. But obviously the important thing there is not showing everything. It's about what the camera frames, isn't it?
Yeah. But, and also just showing London as very cinematic. Mm. I always felt was a bit lacking, in comparison to Paris or New York. I always felt London was always never as utilized. And I think it is as architecturally interesting as those places. It's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just people don't have that fascination with it as much. Maybe UK filmmakers don't have that fascination with location shooting.
But I guess if you're going to spend, I guess London, if you're not doing it guerrilla style, is the expensive place to shoot. And unless people can recognize it's London, there's the Houses of Parliament and there's St.
Exactly,
Paul's.
Yeah.
Have you shot in London, so to speak? Whereas you being a Londoner, you're seeing it, you're seeing the interesting things of London from the point of view of what's interesting, not what makes the rest of the world recognise it as London.
Yeah, I'm working on something at the moment that's period London.
Yeah.
And that's tricky because I'm thinking once we get to shoot that, that's, all my normal techniques are going to be out the window, aren't they?
They are, yes. Like, you're going to need a bit of window dressing.
What am I going to do? We can't just go and follow one of the characters around the West End or around East London.
Hmm.
It doesn't exist, but yeah. So that's going to be a sort of challenge of how you make it still very much in that very fluid style, but obviously. Period.
Mm.
But we'll see. But it can be done.
Now, with the social realism element of that's very evident in Tony, it was interesting that I felt like this was more heightened than real. The whole drug dealer lair and the poem that's recited at him and stuff, that was suddenly very heightened after what felt like side.
So that guy was the real. Completely the real deal in all areas, without going into too much detail. So he used to read those poems.
Mm.
And I knew him from the Shoreditch area.
Right.
He'd never acted before. Obviously he's total real deal.
Mm.
He went off and I think afterwards my casting director cast him in, I think the first Top Boy he was in.
Oh, really?
But yeah, so it was just, again, all these little things. I was like, I've got to get you in the film with your little poems, because he just used to read his poems out in the middle of nightclubs, in the middle of, Shoreditch at like 4 a.m.
Okay, okay.
So yeah, and a couple of those guys in that lair have since OD'd, since died of... drugs.
Right.
So
that's what we're talking about. The dealer guy we're talking about, is it Cyrus Desir or Desir?
Yes.
But that whole setting is that wasn't built then. That you found that location.
No, that was a real it was like a stroke rave like venue
okay.
over in sort of Seven Sisters. It was like full of, and the guy that ran it died shortly after we he died of an overdose shortly after we we rapped. So yeah, that was a great, it was like a illegal nightclub.
Right. Illegal. Okay. Which again speaks to the times, doesn't it? Because there aren't many venues.
None of that was set dressing. We just turned up and it was like it was. And I was like, let's just film as is.
That's magical. Because it looked, honestly, certainly watching it with today's eyes, it looks dressed.
No, none of it. None of those chairs, nothing. We didn't bring any. Got to realise we didn't really have much money for us. I mean, we did Tony's flat, we did quite a bit on. And that was it. We didn't, nothing else. It was Tony's flat was the focus, you know, with the brown wallpaper and just making it. But anyway, it was already pretty rough and ready, Tony's flat. We just helped it a little bit along, you know, put some more grease on the walls and stuff. But it was pretty there already. But yeah, that place was absolutely, as we turned up, we didn't do a thing.
Well, let's take it back then, honestly. Yeah, because it's sort of in the mix of the film, it feels almost like a fantasy element to it. But obviously,
yeah, I think that a little area where they're sitting was like the chill out area for the club. You know what I mean? Yeah, so they had a pot plant there, they had a sofa, a couple of chairs, so people could just like plop down.
You know, like in the way Carpenter does it in Escape to New York. It's like those. Yes. It's that kind of lair, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, it was honestly how we found it. It's probably lovely flats now, I imagine. I don't imagine it's still there.
I mean, when Smudger says that Smudger comments on the state of Tony's flat, you know you've got a bad flat. it was a great moment, that the idea. It's the smell. It's like an old. It's all right. It's like an old person's flat.
And then I'm not old. What we did as well, I got some from Kingsland Road. I got some offal. I bought some offal about 2 weeks before we were going to shoot. So it's 11-day shoot, and I put it in an airtight, you know, one of those parcel bags.
You know,
parcel bag. I put this offal in a parcel bag and left it. I was working in post. I was working. Anyway, I left this bag of offal. And then when we first day of shooting, I opened it up in the flat. So it just stunk the flat out. And obviously got into everyone's... because that was the thing with Nielsen, wasn't it? It was the smell. I mean, it was the drains, obviously, but the smell of that place... You know, of rotting flesh.
Yeah, he's not alone. So I think John Wayne Gacy got found out by that as well, didn't he?
Yeah. That when anyone comes in to the flat and says, "Oh, that stinks," it's because it did. It really stunk.
Only Dawn, Vicky Murdoch. She's the only one. She's the polite one, and it's just so lovely that you know she sees the porno mags, the tissue box on a table, and she says, "You live alone." It's such a great line.
It's funny, you know, as well. That's like Harold would do stuff. Like Harold was doing stuff then to cut the dialogue out midway through that and just have the music come in. I just look back at that and think, well, it's quite an interesting thing I did there, you know, just but that thing of like, oh, let's just cut this dialogue now in the middle of a conversation,
yeah,
and just have the, because it's all about their connection anyway. It's not about what she's saying to him,
exactly. And he does, and it's one of the few moments, because when he has the conversation with the DVD seller, he's being nice, but he's getting nothing back. Whereas suddenly he's invited somebody to his home who is interested in him, not interested in what he can get, and Peter's responses are kind of like, he's guarded, but he's there's a smile, like this is a happy moment in a weird way in a film about a serial killer. This is a happy moment. This is like, and the whole like cute moment over Brussels sprouts, even, you know, it's such a minutiae point, but in that little fleeting moment, he's living his best life, I think, at that point. Tony.
Yeah. Oh, it's lovely because she's nice to it. And we did film another scene with Dawn and Tony at a tenants meeting, which was quite funny.
That gets mentioned, yeah. So
at a tenants meeting. yeah, there's loads of people arguing about kids playing football on the estate. And Tony's just gone there really to have the free biscuits. You know, he's just sitting there.
Do you think he ever went for the roast dinner?
Well, Paul Abbott always wanted to shoot the roast dinner with Dave and the kids.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's nice for us to just think maybe he did.
I think he did.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's just jump to you were left alone to the edit. So you've had this wonderful experience of developing a script and you've been gorilla shooting it and you've created this character and you've made you've given us a cinematic view of London. And then you get into the edit and now you've got other influences on you that are the people that have got stake in the film, because this is where we go from what you've got to what the world will see, isn't it? I suppose that's the important part of this process.
Yeah.
What became that? How involved did that become? And how did that part of the process begin to shape what eventually became the film, Tony?
You know, it was the structure it was. It was very much vignettes and it was Tony's journey. And it was became what whose little interaction with Tony became more important or was stronger. So as I say, there was a few things that a few characters that were left that were cut out. But I suppose then it became, yeah, it was the first time I'd really come into contact with hardcore notes from the Film Council.
When you've not experience of that, what do you remember? Yeah, what do you remember being your response to? Like what? Like
ripping it all up in a rage.
Oh, really? Do they know who I am?
No, it's not even that. It's just like you, obviously, you're so, it's so you. That film is so you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like opening up your diary to someone and them saying, you can't feel like this on this day. You know what I mean? I always feel anyway, when you make a film, you can't help but get too emotionally involved with it. Because you've seen it, especially if you're the writer director, you know, maybe it's different if someone else has written it and you're just directing it, or you've just written it and someone else is directing it. Because you've created those characters, you've seen them through it, you've then filmed it, you're in the edit. I mean, obviously you learn now. I'm not like that. I'm used to notes now, you know what I mean? But this was the first time I remember, I took it personally. What do they mean? What do they mean he's no good? What do they mean that needs tightening? You know, every little bit. But you've got to, as I say, you've got to realize that's the first time I'd ever got notes. And these notes are meant for you know, people that someone probably should have told me, look, just chill out. Which, so I learned pretty quickly that's the way of the world.
So out of interest, how much of the notes were to do with the moral ambiguity of the film? Because obviously the film isn't obviously an advert for killing, but clearly it isn't also saying killing is bad.
I don't think it was. I mean, look, I honestly can't. It was so long ago. Because as well, like we shot that film in 2007.
Right.
So it was 2 years and I went off and was doing telesales, which became a big part of what I wrote about in Muscle.
Muscle, yeah.
But during that time, we were editing it sort of weekends when we could, me and my editor, Ian Davies. And eventually we got into Edinburgh. So that meant that I could leave my job that afternoon and do the film properly and finish it and everything else. So those notes were coming over that 2 year period, I guess, but it's.
Can you remember any? I mean, obviously there's stuff that made you angry, but do you remember any notes that actually helped you make the film? Do you remember?
When I say angry, it was like the initial, I remember just the initial first lot of notes.
Do it every time, Jared. When I get notes on a script, you kind of like, what do you mean?
Of course you do. Of course you do.
And then
you
let it sink in, don't you? And you kind of...
No, you let it sink, yeah.
So do you remember do you remember any notes that became important to what the film become, though? Does anything stand out?
Not really, no.
Well, okay, then. In the edit, what did you find about Tony that you didn't see going into the shoot? What did the story reveal itself to be that changed from how you'd.
Well, I think it was a lot more. I think it said a lot more about society than maybe we thought about at the time. I mean, I was aware of it, you know, the social aspects of it, but I think it was. I think what came out of it was the poignancy and the sadness of it a little bit more, as well as, you know, the humor. As I said, like we didn't intend to make a comedy, but then the film, it just lent itself more to that. But also, yeah, I just felt like there was a little bit of the sadness of the character came through, the melancholia of who he is and what is made. And then I do think that we did have discussions about putting in the father voiceover. So that wasn't written in the script. So that was more to do add more to maybe him. So I mean, there probably was notes. But I don't think there was anything along the lines of we need to make him, you know, less sympathetic or more sympathetic.
But I was thinking, you and your editor, you've got a discovery to make. And obviously, like you said, you've begun to see all this idea that you've actually you're making a bigger comment on society than just following a serial killer around. You know, that the poignancy of the film must have been quite magical to see that you've got this, you know, but story-wise, because obviously you wrap Tony around the story of a missing kid, and obviously where the world believes that Tony is the obvious candidate for doing it. He's the nonce, as Ricky Gover's character calls him, from the moment he sees him. So on an estate, while he's invisible in London, on the estate, he's that guy, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah. And then just, I think we were trying to see how much, well, we shot all that. I think we may have done a pickup shot of the little boy being delivered back to the estate.
Okay.
You know, we had the phone call with Reynolds to say that the kid has been returned. But I think there was more emphasis on the little boy. You know, there was a few inserts of like the little boy being returned to sort of emphasize it a little bit more. I'm trying to think if there was anything that we did in pickups to sort of work on what it was.
I think anyone watching your film who's trying to learn the craft of screenwriting, I think what your film teaches you is the power of suggestion and how little you need to see to understand what's the running narrative. You know, Tony talks to the kid with the football. That's his only interaction with the kid. And then the next time we see him, he's walking off with his bag. Now, we don't know anything's happened. And then a couple of scenes later, the kid is missing. Now, we've seen Tony kill. So I don't even think we as the audience are suspicious, but in that way, that helps put us on Tony's side. When the accusing eyes are on it. And Ricky Grover's character is really interesting because in a way you capture something else there, which is like the impotent rage of a lost parent, you know, and he needs Tony just to get justice. Even if Tony didn't do it, it's for him. It's just somebody to take it out on, isn't it? And that's a really interesting sidebar to the film.
Yeah. And it's one that was there, but I think we did help it along a little bit and try to emphasize that's where the plot kicked in. There was a slight bit of plot. Again, like if I was doing it now, I would be tempted to do so much more. For various reasons, but I'm so glad that it is what it is, you know, where there is not that pressure on doing anything other than it really is a slice of life. And that's what I think is its strength, you know, it really doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, his strength is that people will say, well, nothing much happens. And that's the point. But luckily, it's not 3 hours long.
But didn't, I mean, in a way, though, didn't, isn't that what Scorsese does in Mean Streets in a way? It's kind of
Yeah, I mean, there's those little, again, they're like vignettes, aren't they?
Stories
of people he grew up with and everything else. But yeah, I love the way it's just, because that's exactly what I intended it to be. I didn't want it to be something that had, you know, loads of plot and it was about the, you know, the detective trying to track down the killer or...
police procedure.
You know what I mean, I mean, we didn't really have the budget, but it was about being truthful to just making a character study and really trying to make it feel an authentic snapshot of London during that period. And all the little characters that I'd come across, you know, Tony was based on people I'd known mixed in with like Dennis Nilsson. So there was loads of little bits and pieces that I've made notes with over the years. And it's just throwing everything into the mix and being allowed to do that. And, you know, the film did very well and, you know, got critically acclaimed. And it does just show you that, you know, without any outside influence, that's what you can do.
Because obviously something like, say, Henry Portrait of a Killer got a lot of flack for being like too real or too this, too the other. Was there any sort of reactionary stuff to the piece that you?
No, only that they kept. I mean, obviously, I loved Henry. It's a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The distributors put on the London serial killer tag, which then everyone was then saying, oh, it's not Henry Portrait, it's Tony London serial killer. It was only ever sort of Tony. So it was like, what if Henry existed in the UK and he lived on a shitty diet on a council estate?
Yeah.
But no, I don't. No, I don't think there was too much of a reaction, really, from what I can remember. It was mainly pretty positive.
And as a first time feature, what did you learn from the experience that still stands you in good stead today?
To be prepared for the unpreparable.
Is that what you're saying? Look for black swans.
Obviously it was such a learning curve of doing a feature, but I always looked at it like it was just an extended short, you know, because we were only doing it for 11 days. I was like, right, it's going to be like this. And because I had the scenes set up where they were like little shorts with various actors. As I say, the actors could come and go and only see their scenes because they weren't in other scenes.
Yeah.
You know, so Dawn did her bit, Lorenzo did her bit, George and Fran did their bit. So everyone came in and had their little section of the script and able to shoot chronologically, which is tough because now, you know, when you've got to do nights and you're working on a bit more locations. I mean, I went from doing that to doing Hyena, which had like, you know, hundreds of different locations. It became such a nightmare to then take, you know, to do exactly how that would have turned out. But obviously the workshop process is something that I very much hold dear, and it's something that I really did intensively on that, and still do, but it to a less intense level, I guess, because that was over 6 months, whereas now it's condensed to a few weeks.
Are the main benefits for you for workshopping as opposed to writing scripts for people to then respond to?
No, I do that as well. So the workshop, there's always, I always write the script. The difference. It's not like nothing's devised out of the workshop.
Okay.
That's not what it is. It's I write everything and then we'll bring it in to go over everything. So we might look at we'll look at pages and we'll read, but we'll talk about the characters and it'll be the development of the characters.
Okay.
That's what it'll be. So it'll be, It works for a number of reasons. It's we get a shorthand, the actors and I get a shorthand. So we'll get to know one another so that when we're on set, it's easier because they know what I want and I know what they want. And then we'll develop stuff. We may change things. I mean, I don't think there was a hell of a lot changed on muscle, really. To what I came in with the script. There might be certain things that Craig or Cav may have come up with. But it's pretty much on the page. But that's not what it's just about. It's about going in and having the time to chat and just talk.
Well, I guess you're the creator, so in a way, if they can understand your intent, you can begin to shape that, can't you? Because if you don't know your intent, then what am I trying to achieve is often quite hard.
It's incredibly important, especially my films have a certain atmosphere they exist in a certain immersive environment. So when I'm on set, it's quite immersive into that world.
Yeah.
Tony was, Hyena is, Muscle is, you're immersed in that world for the duration, really. Mm. I try and keep everyone in that world, you know, in that world, and it's quite an exciting journey that we go on. And so that to do that work beforehand it's vital for us to all have that understanding. And also it gets rid of, you know, if there's any sort of funny business, say you don't connect with an actor or something, then there's time to correct it.
Okay, yeah, yeah. It's an expensive thing to find out on set, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And you don't want, you know, you've got to go into a film. It's that huge undertaking you've got to do. It takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of hard work. But you want to ultimately really enjoy it. You want to be excited every day you're going in. You don't want to have egos that are out of control or things that are going to ruin that moment, that precious time for you. Mm. Sometimes there's things that happen that you have to do on the spot. But something like that, where you and your actors have that connection, I just see that as very just a vital part of the process.
Now, to end on a high note, then. So, what's a favourite memory from the Tony shoot that you can share with us?
Well, there were so many. I mean, just like, you know, again, like knowing that I was shooting a feature on the streets, you know, in those locations on film. It was so, I keep saying that word, but so liberating at that time, you know, to be doing it exactly how I intended and not, you know, there's a lot of times people make their first film or the second film and suddenly they're involved with people who are stifling their vision or telling them they can't do this, and they're suddenly getting more stressed. And I don't remember feeling particularly stressed at all during the Tony shoot. And I remember like first day jitters, but I don't remember feeling any like obviously I was just so elated and high to be doing something bigger than a short, you know, with good people behind me, where I was well prepared, where I'd done lots of workshops, and I just felt very empowered to do this little unusual film for what was a tiny budget, but for me at that time, it was a luxury, you know, to have anything other than, you know, like two people doing everything, me helping with the shooting it. It felt like a real luxury at that time. So I just have fond memories.
No, it's great. No, and look, it goes without saying that I'm a huge fan of the film and of your subsequent work. But I just think going back to Tony, it has a resonance because of the conversation we've had about you trying to treat London cinematically as opposed to let's spot London in the film. It really shows in the energy of the film, because it's about Peter's character, not about knowing we're in London. And
And
that makes it such an interesting film. And obviously, the longer we get away from when it was made, then it becomes a social history document of a London that's long gone now.
It's just so weird. As I said to you before, but just going around Soho now, and I miss, you know, there's something about, I mean, obviously, you know, whenever you go to a city, around a red light district is always where the best bars are, the best clubs are. But, you know, Soho now, there's none of it left. It almost feels, I mean, Soho, you've still got a few good pubs, but it's chain after chain after, the soul has gone. The same as in New York now. If you go to Greenwich Village, there's something missing that was there, like even up to '90s and early 2000s.
I mean, I've only lived here 20 years and I feel it. I can't imagine what it's like to have lived here all year, to be born and bred here, to see how it's had that ripped out of it.
I remember when I was a young, like still a school kid, and we, you know, me and my mates would sometimes go up to Soho. It was an edgy, edgy place.
Yeah.
I know, and we were school kids. We were like 15, 16, but you know, it's the same with King's Cross, I guess. I mean, King's Cross now, although I think what they've done with King's Cross, it absolutely looks stunning. So it was not that brilliant how it looked to begin with. But Soho, it's a shame because, yeah, there are still pockets of places and the characters are still holding on, but they're few and far between. And once they're gone, you can't then bring those back, which is shame. So, you know, the pubs and everything else, it does feel that it's less and less of those places. So I've still got to just go and support the ones that are there. That's the thing. But yeah, just looking at that end shot and seeing just by Brewer Street and all around there, it's totally gone now. I mean, you've still got a couple of little places, but it just, as I say, it's always the same with you know, New York or all those big cities, that those areas are always the most vibrant, always the most full of energy. And once you start just developing them into something else, you lose that. I feel it's in some ways it's still the same, but then it's it has changed. It feels safe there now.
On that bright light, I will say thank you very much for giving your time to talk and remember Making Tony. It's a fantastic film.
Thanks, Stuart. Yeah, I deliberately, I don't know whether that was a good thing or not, but I deliberately didn't look on any, I didn't want to familiarise myself with anything, or I just was going to go into it cold rather than start looking at old, do you know what I mean? Because I wanted to be jogged by, as you were talking to me, rather than me just reading off something that just...
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.